From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, politics, economics, and political thought all come together in historian Richard White's newest book, The Republic for Which It Stands. He focuses on Reconstruction and the height of the Gilded Age, years between 1865 and 1896, and discusses how and why America became the world's most powerful economy. He'll join us to talk about the country's growth as an economic and industrial powerhouse and draw parallels to present-day America and concerns over income inequality. Stay with us. That's all next after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Gilded Age in the United States was an era of incredible wealth and innovation, but also crushing poverty and broken promises to ex-slaves and Native Americans. Historian Richard White's new book, The Republic for Which It Stands, The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age, dissects this era of contradictions and makes us understand really what not only Reconstruction was all about, but what the Gilded Age was all about, and takes in, what we're going to talk about in terms of present-day inequality and populism and so many other issues that come up in this book. It's called, again, The Republic for Which It Stands, and the subtitle is The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age takes in the years 1865 to 1896. And we should also mention it's part of the Oxford History of the United States, a series that Richard White has been involved in. And good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be back, Michael.
And I should mention that Richard White is professor of American history at Stanford. Last time you were here, we talked about the railroads, and the railroads, again, play a very significant and integral role in terms of this history. But let's get us rooted in the time here. We begin with actually the death of Abraham Lincoln, and Whitman echoes through my mind, of course. It was a major impact on the United States. The Civil War was over, and there was all this ideal, which Lincoln outlined back in Gettysburg in 1863, of the Union, what the Union would mean. And this is where you begin.
Yeah. Lincoln haunts the age. Lincoln's there at the beginning. Lincoln's going to be there at the end. At the end, as I point out, every American carries Lincoln in their pocket because a Lincoln penny will be coined in the early 20th century. But what Lincoln imagined was a reborn republic, and the easiest way to really think of the Republicans' ambitions for the age is that they wanted the whole of the United States to be Springfield, Illinois, Lincoln's birthplace. It would pretty much be the Nazareth of America. The South would begin to spawn Springfields, and the West would spawn Springfields.
And it would be not only unity, but it would be a kind of homogenization almost, huh?
Yeah, one of the things that the Civil War decides is that there's going to be an equal set of rights. I shouldn't say decides. The ambition is that there will be an equal set of rights enforced by the federal government. If you are a citizen of the United States, you will have the same rights no matter where you go, and the federal government will enforce them. The caveat there, of course, is if you are a citizen of the United States, and if all citizens of the United States are granted those full rights, which, of course, women are not.
Clear out the West and tame the South with Reconstruction?
Pretty much. But again, the way they'd see it is for the noblest of ideals, that when you lose a war, it matters. And as they saw it, there had been two versions of the United States before the Civil War. The North won, and there would now be one version of the United States, and that version would be imposed on the Southern states.
And you're talking about a kind of elite, really, that took charge of the government right after the Civil War and imposed Reconstruction, much to the sadness and dismay of the South. But this was also the beginning of a boom and great growth, Westward Ho and all the rest of that. I mean, you give us all the details of that, as well as the other side of the coin, literally. I mean, the slums, the terrible conditions that existed, as well as that railroad octopus that Frank Norris wrote about in the book The Octopus. There's a real sense here of growth and progress at the same time that Americans are getting shorter than they were in the antebellum period, and they're more, in many ways, especially in the urban areas, deprived.
It's what Henry George, and this comes out of San Francisco in the 19th century, what Henry George summarized as progress and poverty. On one hand, you look at a series of statistics, and the American economy grows enormously, but that's the irony. Americans are shrinking. They're dying younger. Their nutrition is worse. There's what I call an environmental crisis that sweeps over the country, and the two things are connected. Just because there's an expansive capitalism does not mean that life is getting better for most Americans. By many measures we have, it is in fact getting worse.
And not only capitalism, but technology are really taking shape after the Civil War.
It's another parallel to today. This is a time where Americans are amazed at the rapidity of technological change. Locomotives come in, steam engines come in, the ability to move people and goods over vast distances, the telegraph, the telephone. There's a series of things, not all of which are going to hook on in the Gilded Age. They might develop later on. But the inventiveness of the American people, and it's really a vernacular inventiveness. It's not just Thomas Edison, the genius. There's a kind of inventiveness that is spread throughout the society.
It's really, in fact, yesterday Leslie Berlin was on with us, and we were talking about entrepreneurship and, you know, Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley coming into its own in the 70s and so forth. This is true about the period you're writing about. Great entrepreneurship, American wealth. We've got steel and oil, and we've got the robber barons.
And it's connected. We have steel and oil largely because of government policies. Andrew Carnegie is nothing without the tariff. Carnegie would be the first one to admit that. It's government policies that allow him to, in fact, not have to compete against British Steel, which he could not do. It's government policies which help him put down labor rebellions. There's no separating out this entrepreneurship with a kind of government thumb on the scale. There's certain people who are favored by government policies, and those people do very, very well. Those who are not favored don't do so well.
And a lot of productivity, a lot of gains in efficiency, a lot of a foundation for what we think of as mass prosperity. But getting back to yesterday with Leslie Berlin, you're a historian, and I wonder, you mentioned Andrew Carnegie, how much of this is individuals, really? I mean, we're talking about the federal government a great deal, but how much of the single man, usually, in history plays the central role here?
I would say virtually none. I would say that this is a great age of collectivities. I mean, one of the things that sort of surprised me as a historian is finding out how central collectivities were in the Gilded Age, that their ideal is the home. When they talk about themselves, they talk about communities, they talk about churches. And when they talk about what they want to achieve in life, it is not an individual and great wealth. They have a word which we've totally forgotten. It's called competence or competency, which is enough. It's this concept of enough. And once you've achieved enough, there's no reason to keep on working.
Well, we've also got egalitarianism rising up, populism rising up, individualism, all of that, traditions, but up against, really, as you lay it out and delineated, the business ethos and the sense of really business moving forward with in conjunction with the government and with the government's approval and the government's protection.
And the real dominant faction in the Republican Party is not going to be small-L liberals. They're going to be ex-Whigs. They're going to be people who think that the role of the government is to develop the economy. Their hope at the beginning of the period is that that development will benefit everyone. What the problem with the period is that it doesn't benefit everyone, which leads to the social rebellion that follows. It leads to the inequality that follows.
And you write about, as we've said, the broken promises to freed slaves, broken promises to American Indians. Let's talk about that. Let's focus on that.
Sure. The great tragedy of the age, of course, is what happens to freed people, what happens to black people, what happens to ex-slaves. They're going to be promised an equality with other American citizens, and they're going to fight for that equality for 20, 30 years. But in the end, the result is going to be Jim Crow. It's going to be segregation. It's going to be that their political rights are taken away from them. Over most of the United States, black people cannot vote, and they fall into a second-class citizenship, which will not be redeemed until after World War II.
Well, the promises, I mean, were mostly rhetorical, or did they have actually substance in word, indeed?
They had substance, indeed. I mean, the Republicans realized that their fate in the South is tied to the fate of black people, that the Republican Party in the South will dominate if black people can vote. Black people are a majority in many of the Deep South states. So the Republicans have, on the one hand, this intrinsic interest in making sure that this works. On the other hand, the Republicans, too, are racist, not to the same degree as Democrats. And there's always going to be this lingering belief among Republicans that black people are really not up to the task. They're really not equal to white people. They'd be more comfortable if they had a Republican Party based on whites in the South. And that's going to be a fatal flaw along with the pulling out of troops from the South.
I found fascinating, and I think it's a real coup and tribute to your book that you have these photographs and cartoons and Thomas Nast cartoons, for example, which are really fascinating. And what you see is just the divide, I mean, the racial divide in the cartoons and in the photographs, but particularly in the cartoons. Talk about that.
Sure. Thomas Nast is a really good example, because when you see Thomas Nast at the end of the Civil War, you have the full thrust of this egalitarian idealism, the idea that we owe black veterans, the idea that black people are the equal of white people, the idea of he has this multicultural Thanksgiving you think would date from the early 21st century. But if you follow Nast through, by the mid-1870s, his cartoons have turned much, much darker. There's going to be a sense that not only are black people not really up to the task of citizenship, but neither are immigrants. And then he has a famous cartoon of the burden of the South and the burden of the North, one being symbolized by Irish immigrants, the other by freed people. And the message is that neither one is really going to be sufficient to uphold American democracy.
You also have that cartoon just on the other side. I mean, you know, if you're going to extend more freedom to blacks, you're going to have to extend more freedom to the Chinese who are going to take jobs and all the rest of it.
No, and the most viciously racist cartoons, well, I'll have to back off because it's hard to say what are the most viciously racist cartoons in the 19th century. But the Chinese clearly are depicted usually as being subhuman, as being a threat to everything that the United States stands for.
Talking to Richard White, his new book is The Republic for Which It Stands, The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age, 1865 to 1896. And there's so much in this age. We're in the second Gilded Age now, according to many, and so much that's like our own. I mean, concern about freedom for regulation, about the, again, wide expanse between wealth and poverty, the wide divide, but also heavy immigration and divisiveness.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that struck me as I was writing the book is that the time I was writing it within, sitting here in the early 21st century, seemed to echo many of the themes. And I wondered about that because I'm a historian. History doesn't repeat itself. And one of the things I insist on is that the past is different from the present. But I also recognize that there are structural inequalities in the United States, which we fight against but have never really been resolved. And in certain kinds of periods, those all resurface. And it seemed that virtually all the problems that people struggled with in the late 19th century resurface in the early 21st century. We're not them, but there really is a kinship between the problems we face.
There's also an importance that you emphasize that I want to talk about the American identity tied to the idea of home. And it goes back to mug books. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll explain what mug books are, first of all.
Mug books are this publishing phenomenon in the late 19th century. They're county histories where salesmen would come to your door, sell you a subscription to the mug book, and if you subscribed, you would in fact get to dictate what is going to be in the book in regard to you and your family. And the interesting thing for me is everybody decides on the same thing. Especially in the Midwest and California, it's the first settlement, you work hard all your life, you have a prosperous farm. The idea is that a mug book shows up that the achievement of a life is being able to sustain a home. It's having what I referred to earlier as a competency. And this struck me, as I see it over and over again, as the real ideal, the real core of 19th century America.
Also striking that you came across the idea that somehow a lot of the animus that was directed against black people was that they should have homes. Or, in fact, the whole idea of blacks having homes, according to Ku Klux Klan, who would also invade their homes, was antithetical to their view. And you also bring women into this and bring the whole idea of vagrants and tramps and everything. These were homeless people, therefore they weren't really people to be celebrated or to be elevated.
Yeah, the home's a two-edged sword. If you can show that somebody is unworthy of a home, cannot defend a home, cannot establish a home, or is a threat to a home, then that person is unworthy of American citizenship.
So it's like exclusion and inclusion.
Exactly. And that that becomes the tactic that's used against racial minorities and also against tramps, as they're called in the 19th century, to prove that, in fact, they are not entitled to the full citizenship because they are not people who can sustain a home, and that if you allow them full citizenship, they're going to threaten the home. It's used most actively against the Chinese, but also against black people, and it's pervasive.
Yeah, the Homestead Act, though, you had the living wage idea tied to the idea of having a home, right?
And that's the other side. I mean, each side will try to grasp the home. The home's a central cultural symbol. Whoever controls the home is going to be the person who's going to have a political edge. The Homestead Act is we're going to have more homes. Samuel Gompers for Labor, a living wage will allow workers to maintain a home. But the reference is always the same. It always goes back to the home.
Another fascinating side of this history that you're writing here is that suddenly there's an acceleration in life insurance because maybe, as you seem to point out, less belief in providence.
Yeah. One of the things that happens at the end of the Civil War, it started before then, is a sense that your fate is not so much going to be in God's hands, but in a certain point, it's going to be in your own. And there's two things that can happen. You have to, if you're no longer going to have a farm to hand down to your children, you need money. You need some kind of cash to have the family carry on. And that's one motive. The other one is that life insurance allows capital formation. I mean, life insurance companies are some of the biggest investors in Western lands and in other things. So it works both ways. It gives individual security, and it's also providing a great deal of the capital that'll pour into the American economy.
Getting back to just the historical period that you're dealing with here and what evolved, there's more of a sense of trade shifting from east to west, whereas before Reconstruction, it had been largely north to south.
Yeah. The West is developing as a source of resources. I mean, you can't overplay the development of the Western United States because when I started counting up the statistics, it turns out that New York and Brooklyn and Chicago had as many people as all the area west of the 100th Meridian in 1890s minus San Francisco. And San Francisco contains about a quarter of the people in California. So what you have is an urban East is the place that's growing the fastest, but the West is important as the source of resources that will come in and as an outlet for capital, some of which is wasted, but a lot of it is poured into the Western United States.
And slaughtering of Native Americans in Buffalo.
Well, what you have is that for the United States to prosper, and this has been since the early 19th century, the paradox of American democracy, and it's a paradox that they recognize. For Americans to have what they claim to be freedom, free labor and contract freedom, you have to restrict Indian freedom. For Americans to get land, you have to take land away from the Indians. And in the 19th century, as in the 18th century, and in some ways in the 20th century, American progress is not good news for Native peoples.
Again, Richard White here with us in studio, professor of American history at Stanford and author of The Republic for Which It Stands. There is the rise of Jim Crow at this period that you're writing about, too, the ascendancy of Jim Crow, which is essentially exclusion and segregation of black people on the heels of what was supposed to be the freedom and the emancipation. And we're also talking about the rise of corporations, really. And with that and attendant on that is corruption, is systemic corruption. It's not only the corporations working in league with the United States, as you write it, and some would see this as, by the way, a progressive or liberal view of mm-hmm. liberal history. I'm sure right. you've had some of that pushback. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that Boss Tweed, for example, the boss of New York and all of these kind of corrupt satrapies or whatever you want to call them were burgeoning all over the United States, but particularly in a corporate level.
Yeah. What you have is both corporations and private government and in private, excuse me, private corporations and in government is this idea of profit. I mean, the profit motive enters into government. It, in some ways, it parallels the present in an eerie way. The idea is that if you turn over government functions to private corporations, you won't have to tax people as much and you'll get more efficient service. What you get, in fact, is incredible corruption and a rebellion against it, which will lead to to the rise of modern bureaucracies. If your office depends on making a profit, you will do the most profitable thing.
And you mentioned Carnegie before. I mean, there's a good example of what tipped off labor struggles and everything, bringing in Pinkerton detectives and all that.
Exactly. And in fact, he brings in Pinkertons because he can't get the state militia to intervene. And when the state militia does intervene, of course, it will intervene on his side. But there's this idea, as I said before, the government's thumb is on the scale, and it's going to be on the scale helping the privileged and against the underprivileged.
And that was essentially also the idea of the unity that you spoke of before. This is going to be the new America of the Gilded Age.
Yeah. The ideal is one that it's hard to quarrel with. The ideal is that you are going to have free and independent citizens who are going to reap the benefits of their own labor. It will be a society without very rich, without very poor, what they referred to as the dangerous classes, and that all those things will be guaranteed by the federal government in an even-handed manner in North and South and West, and it won't depend on race, at least between white people and black people. It's very hard to quarrel with that as an ideal for what you want to achieve.
Well, again, we're talking to Richard White, and I want to bring our listeners into this, the Gilded Age, an era of incredible wealth and innovation, but also crushing poverty. And by the way, the crushing poverty, a lot of it was urban. You had terrible smallpox outbreaks. You had terrible not only diseases, but unsanitary conditions that were mind-blowing to read about. And it actually, in that sense, was good because it ushered in some real changes, some major changes.
Yeah, I would say that, in fact, the intervention of government begins to be effective on the local level, the urban level, and it's precisely because of this environmental crisis.
I'd like to invite our callers, and some of you may have questions about this era that we're talking about the late 1800s. It goes right up to, the book takes us from 1865, right after the Civil War, to 1896. We'd like to hear from you. So if you have questions or if you have comments, please feel free to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available now. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, join us by calling in at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Ben wants to know the role of immigration and what it played in the constant growth and different places that particular immigrant groups moved to.
Immigration is pervasive in all of the United States except the South. I mean, it's one of the things that marks out off the South. In the 19th century, you can make generalizations about the United States, and you always say, except the South. The South is the place where they don't go. But the West is heavily immigrant. San Francisco was heavily immigrant. It was more immigrant in the 1880s than it is today, at least until the next census. Urban areas are also heavily immigrant, but so is Wisconsin. I mean, immigration is across the board in the Midwest, the East, the West, every place but the South, and they provide much of the labor force for industrialization. There are also, as today, there's a large number of immigrants, many of whom are Catholic and then Jewish, are going to lead to a backlash, a kind of nativism, that they cannot be fully assimilated, they can't really be Americans, that they're a threat to the Republic, and that they're even blamed for the declining family size of native-born Americans. They say they simply won't have children because they can't compete against immigrants.
It's true, though, isn't it, that most of the changes that began to take place, I was alluding to them, for example, making things cleaner and at least more healthy and so forth, from the ground up?
Yeah, it's when you look at the reform, a lot of it is going to come because people are alarmed by the conditions that they are living in, their children are living in, and they're having to establish homes in. So that the best sign of that is going to be the kinds of reforms that take place in urban areas. They're going to be environmental reforms. Environmental reforms are not this sort of cosmetic put on top of the society. They're just fundamental to the way people live, and that's the things that people want to change.
Again, we're talking about this crucial period of American history, Reconstruction and the Gilded Age from 1865 to 1896 with Richard Wright, professor of history, American history at Stanford, and author of The Republic for Which It Stands. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with historian Richard White, who has written about Reconstruction and the Gilded Age here in the United States and echoes of both very strongly in today. It was indeed a period of wealth and innovation, crushing poverty, government corruption, broken promises to former slaves and Native Americans. And the new book is called The Republic for Which It Stands, The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age. And really dissects this era of contradictions and what it means for present-day inequality and populism, among many other things. And I should also add that you are welcome to join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or join us by calling us, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just want to touch on a couple quick things. One is, when we talk about the liberals of that day, we have a very different meaning than when we talk about liberals today.
Yep. This is a misunderstanding that's shown up actually in some of the reviews and responses to the book. I'm talking about small L liberals. And there are really the progenitors of modern liberals in terms of civil liberties, but they're also closest perhaps to modern libertarians and have much in common with modern conservatives.
They are, in fact, in terms of being much in common with conservatives, against a lot of the federal government involvement.
Yeah, they believe in small government. They believe in property rights. And in this way, they're very close to modern conservatives.
Also, can I ask you about General Grant, President Grant, Ulysses S. Grant? Because Ron Chernow, who did the biography of Alexander Hamilton, which was made, of course, into Hamilton, the great Broadway hit, he has a very critical biography out. I think we're going to feature him on Forum of Grant. A very positive view of Grant in many ways. Yours is much more critical.
Mine is much more critical, and I have a great deal of admiration for Ron Chernow. And I'll have to say, because the book is just out, I have glanced at the book, but I have not read it thoroughly. But my portrait of Grant is, from all the reviews I've read, very different from his, and it goes from the existing scholarship and from the stuff I've seen. I haven't seen much reason to change my opinion. I'm not arguing about Grant as a general, and I'm not arguing about Grant as in many ways a tragic figure, which I make him in the book. I'm just saying that Grant was a terrible president.
Well, he was also had a serious problem with alcoholism, and he was also corrupt in many ways. But he also broke the KKK, didn't he?
That's the paradox of him, is that he himself, I don't think, is corrupt. He surrounds himself with corrupt people. He wants to be rich, and there's a kind of innocence about Grant. I mean, he trusts people who should not be trusted. He values loyalty, and those people who are loyal to them, he is loyal in return, and he should not have been. But he also will both abandon black people and then at a certain time send troops in. He'll send the 7th Cavalry into South Carolina. They break the Klan. But then he withdraws them again. He fires his attorney general, who's the biggest supporter of black civil rights. So he's paradoxical. He doesn't sustain the effort, and you need to sustain the effort to protect black rights.
It's also notoriously anti-Semitic and pretty much characterized by you as avaricious. I mean, greedy, really.
He wants to be rich, and he's anti-Semitic. He's also anti-Catholic. He fears the power of the Catholic Church, but in that way, he's very much like most 19th century Protestants. He says if there's going to be another civil war, it will be between Protestants and Catholics.
Let's go to your calls, and let's go first to Benicia and welcome Corey. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for having me. The question that I had, well, actually, I wanted to make a comment. As a young African-American voter, I'm having a very hard time being able to relate to democracy and liberalism and Democrats, mainly because it seems as if the Democrats have kind of lost, this kind of passion to really stand up for civil rights issues. And one of my comments that I wanted to make is, I saw an article recently where the United Nations ruled that it is time for African Americans to receive reparations in America. And I think that reparations is a much bigger issue than kind of just helping black people catch up. I think it's an issue that's kind of been pinning civil rights and holding civil rights down for the entire country. And I say that because when you have 400 years of degradation of one specific group in the country, and then you have no resolve for that, but we constantly bring in immigrants and bring in other people in the country without really addressing that issue, I think it sends a signal to a lot of the people that, America's not really about, justice and equality. So one of the questions I wanted to ask is, why is it that liberals and Democrats don't stand up for reparations for this country? And do you all feel that, as time progressed, that reparations is an issue that would kind of fall under the cracks and become something that we never, ever get a chance to really see?
Well, reparations is a very old issue. It became the first issue that freed people brought up at the end of the Civil War. What they wanted is 40 acres and a mule. The argument was, having had to labor for other people and having had to build up the wealth of the United States during slavery, they were entitled to get a share of that now that they were freed. And it was a real issue in the Republican Party for a long time. It was not something that was immediately dismissed. In the end, it failed. And it failed partially because, while the United States is perfectly willing to take land away from Indian people and give it to white people, it turned out to be very different, and there were real constitutional bars about taking it away from white people to give it to black people. So reparations as a vital issue fell in the early parts of Reconstruction, and things turned to the vote. The vote will be enough. As it turned out, the vote was not enough. So raising reparations, it comes and it goes. But when you start talking about it in the present day, you're referring back to something which dates back to Reconstruction and the Gilded Age.
And we thank you, Corey, for the question. I want to bring more of your calls on here. Let me go next to Berkeley. Gary, join us.
Professor White, thank you very much for your work. You talk about the transition of the capitalist model from passing on wealth in terms of a farm to the life insurance companies. Can you use your study of history to look at where we are today and see, is there any, if you were put in charge, is there any course we can take to try to right the ship and bring about a fundamental change to the way we're doing business to equalize things?
Well, the argument I'd make is that there are various kinds of capitalism. And in the late after the Civil War and Reconstruction, the goal is to have a capitalism which will produce a large middling class that will not be very rich, that will not be very poor. The idea is that competition will ensure that very rich and very poor will not exist. That turns out, in fact, to be false. But I would go back to other ideas that are there, which we now think is un-American, but they're profoundly American. And one of them is this idea of a competency, that the goal of the so-called American dream is not to be incredibly wealthy. The idea is to have a sufficiency to take care of your family, to take care of yourself in old age, and to support basic common institutions. This gets warped into a kind of individualism where the goal of American society is to allow any particular individual to accumulate as much as they possibly can. As long as that remains the goal in the economy, it seems to me very hard to sustain any sort of equitable society, and you're going to get the kinds of problems that you see today.
And I thank you, Gary, for the call. I'll get to more of your calls in just a moment. I'm wondering, again, the role of providence in this. You write about John D. Rockefeller, for example, and God gave me my money. I mean, there was this idea that somehow you were a member of the Calvinist Blessed or whatever, the elite, and it had to do again with God, destiny.
Yeah. There is the rich have various explanations for how they got their money. I mean, Carnegie will say it's because of his ability. Rockefeller says he's a steward, that God gave it to him. Charles Francis Adams, who is much more honest about it, says that they lied, cheated, and stole. It's various people come up with various ideas, but the interesting thing is all of them have to justify an amount of wealth that had not existed in the United States before. It wasn't that people took this for granted. That is, how in the world did you come to have so much when so many people have so little?
Were those cartoons that we were talking about before, where they were always represented as obese, you know, they were the first fat cats, I guess, really.
Yeah, fat cats is precisely what they were. And those cartoons are just ubiquitous throughout the Gilded Age. They're everywhere. If you think this is a time where Americans admired great wealth, just go back and start looking at those cartoons.
And we'll take more of your calls. Let me bring on Matthew from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Thank you for the conversation and for focusing on the place of the disadvantaged in this era. I was wondering if you could comment on how the political rights of citizens changed or didn't change in this era.
The initial move is they greatly expanded. What you have is the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And what you have is the federal government saying it will enforce civil rights across the nation. What you then get, starting in the 1870s, is a rollback. You get disenfranchisement of black people. You get the failure to enfranchise women, which will not take place. You will have the exclusion of Chinese from citizenship, which will be sustained. You will have Indian peoples will exist as having a set of semi-sovereign rights, treaty rights are going to be abrogated more and more as the 19th century goes on. So what you have is a set of promises which still exist, which becomes a legal basis for the civil rights movement, but you get a rollback, a failure to enforce those over much of the 19th century. So legally, everything improves. Practically, not so much.
Again, my thanks for the call. I noticed that Yale's David Blight, a famous historian, calls you our Mark Twain with archival and footnotes, authority of footnotes and archives. But reminded me of the fact that you bring up, I mean, it was wonderful praise from Professor Blight, but also bring up William Dean Howells, who's a figure that many people don't remember, who was, another, like Twain, a major literary figure in this period, and the whole idea of the commons. This comes forward in a central way at this period, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, one of the best pieces of advice I got in writing the book is somebody asked me, who's your Dilbert? Who's the person who stands inside this and observes what's going on and knows that something's going wrong but is trying to puzzle out what it is? That became William Dean Howells. So William Dean Howells is my voice, the person who really articulates for me how an intelligent Gilded Age person is going to look at what's happening. And he has this quote, which struck me. And he said, what America is about is the sufficiency of the common and the insufficiency of the uncommon. And I puzzled about that. And what I think it means, I'm pretty sure what it means, is that if in fact the common people of the United States, the basis of the republic and a democracy, are in good shape and hold what Howells would consider decent democratic values, the country will be okay. If they're not, it doesn't matter how many uncommon people you produce. The republic is going to be doomed. And they really care about the republic in a way that it's hard for us to recover because, remember, they had just fought a bloody civil war to preserve the republic. The idea that having fought that war, the republic was going to give way to class conflict, to the rise of the dangerous classes, appalled them.
Listener wants to know, what about more on corporate personhood, the Supreme Court decisions from the 1800s?
That's a very complicated problem because the first mention of that is going to come early, but it's really only to the end of my period in the 1890s that the court will begin to really bring corporate personhood into a kind of legal basis where it'll have much of an effect. So before that, it's a word. And then many people thought it's ridiculous. I would say the consensus in the Gilded Age is that, of course, a corporate person is not the same as a physical person. To begin to contend that, to contend that you can give them the kind of rights that were intended for actual individuals is crazy. It's in the early 20th century where it's not going to seem so crazy, and it's in the early 21st century where if, in fact, people looked at recent Supreme Court decisions from and were living in the late 19th century, they would think we were lunatics.
Nancy wants to know if you can address the beginning of the U.S. women's movement at Seneca Falls, which eventually focused on suffrage throughout the Gilded Age.
Seneca Falls comes before my period, but I spend a great deal of time on the women's movement. And the thing to remember is there really are two women's movements during the time I'm writing about. One is going to be based on individualism, small-L liberalism. It's Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who is probably the most consistent liberal in the late 19th century, that women should have the same individual rights as men. The other and more influential one is going to be Frances Willard and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And the argument is that women are different from men. Women are critical to sustaining the home, and therefore women need the kinds of rights that are necessary to make the home viable. That's the one that's going to push forward into the 20th century.
There's the home again. Women didn't get the vote till 1920. A lot of people don't realize.
Right.
But there's a whole sense that you're writing about here of how things are just moving forward at such a fast clip and such a fast pace. I mean, not only technologically, as we said earlier, but socially.
In that way, it's parallel to today, is that just when you think you've grasped one change, it's gone and something else is in its place. There's this sense that a world which had changed slowly, if at all, is suddenly in this mad rush into the future. And people are trying basically to understand it, to try to see how can we have a set of values we believe in and apply them to a world which is utterly different from the ones our parents lived in.
Another question from Marcia, who's interested to hear how slavery transformed into the convict labor system. For example, ex-slaves were arrested as vagrants who then became convict labor in Alabama coal mines, which was then used to make their steel in the North.
It becomes one of the dirty secrets of Reconstruction in Jim Crow era. And it's mostly in the South, but it's not just in the South. The end of slavery turns out not to mean the end of coerced labor. And there's a whole system that develops for black people who are arrested or have small debts, who cannot pay fines or pay the debts, are going to be leased out until the debts can be paid or the fines can be paid. And they will be sent into some of the most brutal industrial conditions in the United States. And large numbers of them will die. The best example of this is John Henry, the folk song. There's a wonderful book on John Henry, which shows that what John Henry was is somebody who is sentenced to work in the mines, digging railroad tunnels, because he cannot pay a fine, and it costs him his life.
Let me go to more of your calls and remind you that our guest is Richard White, professor of American history at Stanford, author of The Republic for Which It Stands. And Sherman, you're our next caller. Thanks for waiting.
Michael, thank you for having me, and thank you for a wonderful guest. Mike, I got a question. How much misery and loss of money would be averted if Congress had only ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo? I recall the year was 1849 at the end of the Mexican-American War that it absolutely guaranteed the free exchange of people and goods across the border with protection of people and assets. Had that been ratified by a reticent Congress who sent the negotiators to conclude that treaty, Guadalupe Hidalgo, how much misery, how much better off both our countries and North America would be today?
Well, the treaty was ratified. It's the basis of many of the political rights that are given to people who had been Mexicans who became Americans in the United States. The idea of free transit across the border, that, in fact, existed for a very long time because the United States lacked the administrative capacity to do much of anything else. It really did not have strict border controls in the 19th century. People moved freely back and forth across these borders. The major people coming up at the time, oddly enough, were not going to be Mexicans in the 1880s and 1890s. They were going to be Chinese. And that's where the rebellion is going to come. And a lot of the violence against Chinese is going to be Chinese who have immigrated in over the Canadian and Mexican borders, because the Canadian border was just as porous as the Mexican border.
Let me thank the caller. You know, there's so much that you cover in this book. I called it a tome because it is a tome. It's an extraordinary piece of research, but I'm just wondering how it all – I'm wondering about how you work. I mean, history buffs will love this because, you know, they can find out about Haymarket, about Wounded Knee, about the Orange Riot. I mean, there's just so much here, and yet the Panic of 1873, just covering that kind of terrain. I mean, you have to really sit down and you can work chronologically and methodically and everything, but you manage to get the expansiveness along with the focus.
Well, I try to do two things. The first thing is it has to be a story. And for me, the story is how can the Republican Party, having so many advantages in 1865 and such a clear idea of the America they wanted to create, find themselves living in a world so different in 1896? So one of them is going to be, to quote another author who has a book out this fall, what happened? What in the world happened that a vision which was so clear was not achieved? And that becomes part of it. And the second one is to go back and to try to recover the strangeness of the past. How do people understand their world? And this usually is hiding in plain sight. I take the home, but the home is everywhere in the 19th century. But historians, because it's so ubiquitous, it seems so bland, they ignore it. And once I have this central idea, they begin to understand what's happening in terms of what happens to the home. Then I begin to work all of these things together, because they're right. Everything does affect the home.
And I read something that you wrote in the Smithsonian where you said, we don't have anything like that now. We need something perhaps like that that can bring us together, collectivist identity.
You know, I struggle over that, and I introduce it to audiences, and people suggest the family and that maybe family will do it. And family is different from the home because families exist within homes. But I'm not sure if family has the same grasp. But there is, I am convinced that we cannot have productive arguments until we agree what we are arguing about, because so many of the arguments in the 21st century are people just talking past each other. They agree not only on the basic facts, but they don't even agree on concepts.
Well, we'll agree to take some more of your calls. Let me go next to Vallejo. Odila, good morning.
Hi, this is Alita. Thank you. Both to what you just mentioned on what happens now when we talk about the against the underprivileged, there's this thing of agree on disagreeing I believe in the new economy sense, like the international global perspective of the World Social Forum, the U.S. Social Forum. And I wanted to hear what you thought about this new economy when we talk about, since Black Lives Matter, co-housing and international communities and even, you know, worker centers like the hubs and co-spaces are looking at Quilombos and Pilinques and Maroon Villages and Asusumas in a different perspective than what we did before, using the new economy sense. I'm wondering if you think that works, since we're talking about the process of agreeing and disagreeing to move forward.
I think that much of what we talk about the new economy, when people talk about it, is, first of all, it's not so new, and strikes me as largely this kind of classical small L liberalism, that people who will compete and will get what they deserve, and that in fact it's going to be an economy which is not confined just to the United States, but globally we have to be able to compete globally. The difference is going to be between now and then is that they were much more economic nationalists. They set up tariffs. They began to argue that America is going to be special. What we need is an American wage. What we can't do is compete internationally because it hurts American workers. It hurts American businesses. They can sound like Donald Trump at one moment.
Just what I was thinking.
And they can also sound like Silicon Valley liberals at another moment. And I think, in fact, that kind of incoherence is still present today.
It's a big country.
Yeah.
Let me go to more calls, and let's bring in a listener from Oakland. Cottrell, do I have your name correct?
Yes, that's right, Cottrell Smith.
Hi.
First of all, Michael, thanks for having this show. It's fantastic, and thank you for a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate it. It's a very interesting topic. I do have a couple questions, maybe, slash comments. So, you know, I feel like it goes down to the, or comes my comments around the kind of mythology around Ulysses S. Grant, who is such an important person in this era. And I wonder, you know, I feel like there was, I guess I wonder what your guest has to say about the mythology around Grant's corruption, because it feels to me that, you know, especially from a modern perspective in comparison to our current presidents, wasn't this idea of him being super corrupt kind of overblown? And secondly, I guess also the commenter and yourself, Michael, I guess referred to Grant as being anti-Semitic. And in my research of Grant, I've only heard, you know, or I've only found him having made one comment that can kind of construed as anti-Semitic. And is that not also kind of an overblown, I don't know, I guess, part of his mythology, which
oh, you're asking if we've overblown his corruption and overblown his anti-Semitism, Richard White?
Yeah, I think most historians don't argue that Grant was personally corrupt. He was surrounded by corrupt people who he really would not remove from office until he was forced to. He would be in utter denial about this. He said at one point he only knew six people, I think, that were corrupt in his whole life. I'd argue at any given time he had that many in his cabinet. So he's not corrupt, but he has a corrupt administration. And in terms of anti-Semitism, he's the sort of casual anti-Semite that you find all over the 19th century, but he's much more actively anti-Catholic. I mean, he does give his famous speech in Iowa where he warns that the Catholic Church and Catholics are the great danger to the United States.
Let me thank you for the call, Cottrell, and we'll bring on another caller here, and that's you. Jory, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. You stated earlier that you didn't think that history repeated itself, and then you went on to give examples such as when times are hard and people get afraid, they turn on immigrants, and the Gilded Age repeating itself. I was wondering what examples spring to mind or how you can talk in general terms about how history doesn't repeat itself. And obviously technology is one example that I think is kind of trivial.
Well, I think the major reason history doesn't repeat itself is if you go back to the 19th century, you will find people who are our ancestors, many of our ancestors, but they think about the world differently than we do. They conceive of problems differently than we do. What seems to be history repeating itself is things which is not so much repetition as things that have never gone away. The problem of inequality in the United States has never gone away. The problem of white supremacy in the United States has never gone away. So for me, these things are not repetitions. These are the substructure, which are sometimes more visible than other times. But the way we relate to them, it's how we decide what to do with them, that's always going to be different in different eras, because we have now incorporated all the changes since the Gilded Age, and they've made us different people.
Let me thank Joy for the call. Regarding income inequality, I have a tweet from Colin that says, that and innovation, did people at the time discuss Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species? It was published 1859.
Yeah, they did, and they misunderstood it and oversimplified it. I mean, one of the things I argue against in the book is the idea of social Darwinism, the idea that you can take evolutionary theory and apply it to society, which basically misunderstands Darwinian theory. But more important is most Americans did not believe that. Social Darwinists are a small minority and not particularly influential minority. And they've been were resurrected in Richard Hofstadter's brilliant book, but I think wrong-headed book, that makes them the dominant group instead of a kind of liberalism in retreat.
And a question from James might be a good way to conclude here this morning with you, Richard White. He wants to know, what is Richard White's opinion of how Reconstruction would have been different if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated?
This is going to seem heretical, but I don't think it would have made that much difference about Lincoln's assassination. I think what makes the difference is what the Republican Party chooses to do in the late 1860s. For me, the critical thing is, are you going to take the army and move it to the West, or are you going to keep the army in the South to guarantee black rights until stable governments are set up and to suppress civil rebellions, which are attacks on black people? The United States doesn't do that. Reconstruction seems to be successful when there is a threat of military force. After that, it fades.
Other historians have already taken you on about the idea that the military in the South and the military in the West were to essentially curb blacks in the South and curb the Indians, Native Americans in the West. You want to reinforce that thesis just before we go on?
Sure. I mean, what I'm relying on is a tremendous book by Greg Downs, which is about looking at the placement of troops in the South and looking at the ways in which they argue that the rebellion is not over until civil disturbance starts and governments are in place. Richard, so Boyd, I'm on pretty solid grounds, I think.
Always a pleasure. You are on solid ground. I appreciate your being here with us on your solid ground. Again, the book is The Republic for Which It Stands. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.